Welcome to this July 2026 review of dermatologic surgery. We've got four pieces on the docket this month. A randomized trial on at-home light devices for acne. A cross-sectional look at how indoor tanning is being sold to young people on TikTok. A reconstructive conundrum tackling a full-thickness alar and cil defect. And a commentary on the messy semantics of skin quality. Let's get into it. First up is an original article. An open-label randomized controlled trial comparing two at-home light-emitting diode devices for mild to moderate inflammatory acne. An investigational combination red and blue LED device, 660 nanometer red paired with 415 nanometer blue, against a commercially available blue-only 415 nanometer LED device that's already FDA cleared. The background here is familiar mechanistic territory you already know. Blue light in that 407 to 420 nanometer range hits the peak absorption of Cutibacterium acnes porphyrins and drives photodestruction, while red light penetrates more deeply to reach the sebaceous gland itself, theoretically adding an anti-inflammatory, deeper tissue effect that blue light alone can't achieve. The specific gap the authors are chasing is whether bolting red onto an existing blue home use platform actually buys you anything clinically. Since in vitro data have actually shown blue light is the more potent bactericidal wavelength, and red needs much greater intensity to achieve equivalent bacterial kill. Methodologically, this was a small pilot trial. Target enrollment of 30 subjects, randomized 2-to-1 into the combination device and the blue-only comparator. Subjects needed a global assessment score of 2-to-3 and a total lesion count between 10 and 60, essentially a mild to moderate inflammatory phenotype. And they were excluded if they were on any concurrent acne therapy or had recent facial laser work, which is a sensible attempt to isolate the device's own effect from confounding treatments. It was open label, and the authors don't explicitly defend that choice, but the reasoning is fairly intuitive here. The two devices look and function completely differently. One uses a spacer and continuous emission, the other requires skin contact and a disposable timing cartridge. So blinding subjects to which device they're using would have been essentially impossible without an elaborate sham design that a small pilot study likely couldn't justify resourcing. Outcomes were assessed by the investigator at 4 and 8 weeks, total inflammatory and non-inflammatory lesion counts, an investigator global assessment score, and satisfaction and willingness to recommend on Likert scales. They used a mixed effects repeated measures model for the lesion counts, and a generalized estimating equation for the ordinal global assessment score, which is the right toolkit for correlated, repeated within-subject data collected at multiple time points, rather than treating each visit as an independent sample. On results, 23 of the original 30 subjects completed both follow-ups. The combination red-blue device produced a statistically significant drop in total lesion count at both 4 and 8 weeks, whereas the blue-only device did not reach significance at either time point, though it trended that way by 8 weeks. Despite that asymmetry, when the two groups were compared head-to-head, there was no significant difference between them in total lesion reduction. Both landed around a quarter to a third reduction from baseline. Inflammatory lesions improved significantly with both devices at both time points, again with no significant between-group difference, though the combination device showed a notably larger relative reduction, roughly three-quarters versus about half for blue alone. Worth knowing, but the study wasn't powered to call that a true group difference. Non-inflammatory lesions didn't significantly improve in either arm. The one finding that did favor the combination device outright was the median investigator global assessment score at 8 weeks, which was significantly lower with the red-blue device than with blue alone. Subject willingness to recommend the treatment was also significantly higher with the combination device. Safety was reassuring overall, though two subjects using the combination device developed small first-degree burns on the malar cheek that resolved within a week with simple wound care. Nothing occurred in the blue-only arm. The discussion is appropriately restrained. The authors conclude the combination device isn't clearly superior to blue-only for lesion counts, but it may work faster on inflammatory lesions, and it did win on the global assessment and recommendation metrics. The obvious limitations are the small sample size, the pilot design, the open-label assessment introducing potential observer bias despite standardized photography, meaningful loss to follow-up relative to a 30-person cohort, and self-reported compliance that wasn't independently verified. For your practice, this is interesting but not practice-changing. It's a small, funded pilot study, not a confirmatory trial. and the between group comparisons were mostly null. The one practical nugget worth banking is the burn signal. If patients ask you about combination red-blue home devices, it's reasonable to counsel that thermal injury, while uncommon and self-limited, is a real possibility with continuous higher irradiance red-blue systems, and proper device spacing and use as directed matters. Next is a communications piece, a cross-sectional content analysis, not a clinical study, looking at how indoor tanning is being portrayed on TikTok. The motivating problem is one you know well. Tanning bed use before age 35 raises melanoma risk by roughly 60%, and independently raises basal and squamous cell carcinoma risk. Yet indoor tanning remains common among young adults, and the authors wanted to characterize the social media environment shaping those attitudes. Methodologically, they created a fresh TikTok account specifically to minimize algorithmic personalization bias, searched tanning bed, and pulled the first 200 videos under the top rank tab, excluding duplicates, low engagement posts, and irrelevant content, leaving 175 videos for analysis, stance, engagement metrics, and the top three comments per video to see how audiences reinforced or pushed back on the creator's message. This is a reasonable, transparent way to snapshot platform content on a given day, though as with any single day, single search term sample, it's a snapshot, not a longitudinal or comprehensive picture of the platform. The results are stark. 88% of creators expressed a pro-tanning stance. Pro-tanning content dwarfed anti-tanning content in every engagement metric. Likes were nearly tenfold higher. Comments were about 4.5-fold higher. Bookmarks about tenfold higher, meaning the algorithm and audience behavior are actively amplifying the pro-tanning message over the cautionary one. Health professionals authored only about 1 in 20 videos, and skin cancer survivors an even smaller share, while tanning salons themselves produced 1 in 10 videos. Unsurprisingly, all promotional. Nearly half of videos showed creators actively tanning, and of those, well over half showed no eye protection. Comment sentiment mirrored the video content, skewing pro-tanning by roughly 2-to-1 over anti-tanning. The thematic breakdown is illuminating for counseling purposes. Anti-tanning comments centered on cancer risk and personal or secondhand survivor experience, while pro-tanning justifications leaned heavily on mental health and seasonal mood benefits, comparisons to other acceptable unhealthy behaviors like smoking or drinking, and cosmetic improvement in acne or texture. Vitamin D and psoriasis benefit claims also featured prominently. The discussion pushes back point by point on these claims. Early tanning bed use is actually associated with higher rates of anxiety and depression later in life, not less. And the ultraviolet-triggered endorphin release that may explain the mood boost people report also underlies a genuine addictive potential, with validated screening tools and cognitive behavioral therapy now available for that phenotype. On psoriasis, the authors note commercial tanning beds are UVA-dominant, while therapeutic phototherapy is calibrated UVB, and neither the National Psoriasis Foundation nor the Academy endorses tanning beds as a phototherapy substitute. On vitamin D, cited trial data show levels plateau within minutes of UVB exposure, meaning any incremental vitamin D benefit is trivial compared with the carcinogenic cost. This isn't a hypothesis testing study, so there's no traditional limitations section, but the obvious caveat is generalizability. One platform, one day, one search term, coded by a small team. Practically, this won't change how you manage a patient in front of you, but it's a useful, quotable data point for why patient education needs to actively engage the mental health and lifestyle framing patients are absorbing online, rather than relying solely on cancer risk messaging, which this data suggests is being drowned out algorithmically. Third is a reconstructive conundrum, a case-based technique presentation working through a full-thickness defect. A 55-year-old man had a squamous cell carcinoma of the left nasal ala, cleared over 2 stages of Mohs surgery, leaving a roughly 2x2 cm defect spanning the lateral ala, alar base, nasal sill, the internal lining of the posterior vestibule, and the upper cutaneous lip. About as complex a central face defect as you'll encounter, involving all 3 structural layers, plus an adjacent cosmetic subunit. The teaching framework the authors use is the classic one for full-thickness alar work. Internal lining, cartilaginous framework, and external skin envelope each need independent reconstruction. For the internal lining, they considered a bipedicle vestibular advancement flap, but opted instead for a buccal mucosal graft, reasoning that, since this defect was in the posterior vestibule, rather than at a free margin, a graft, rather than a local vestibular flap, would provide adequate non-bulky lining. The graft was oversized by about 20% to compensate for contracture, harvested with a thin cuff of submucosal tissue while avoiding the Stenson duct, and left to heal secondarily at the donor site. For structural support, they harvested a cartilage graft from the antihelix to rebuild the alar ring at the sill, a location deep enough that a cutaneous flap alone couldn't provide adequate projection. The graft did double duty, completing the ring and preventing alar base retraction. For the cutaneous envelope, they used a combination repair keyed to cosmetic subunits. An island pedicle advancement flap reconstructed the upper cutaneous lip, and a folded-over paranasal interpolation flap covered the lateral ala, with the distal flap thinned and folded to simultaneously provide external cover and reconstitute missing internal lining at the alar rim. Sutured along subunit borders to keep scars camouflaged. Pedicle division occurred at 3 weeks, and at 20-month follow-up the patient had a patent airway and what's described as an excellent functional and cosmetic result. The takeaway points the authors highlight are ones worth internalizing as a framework rather than a one-off recipe. Treat lining, structure, and cover as three independent reconstructive problems in full-thickness nasal defects. Buccal mucosa is a reliable low-bulk lining source when you're not dealing with a free margin. And for defects crossing multiple aesthetic subunits, combining flap types while respecting subunit boundaries is what gets you a natural, camouflaged result rather than a single large flap forced across incompatible contours. Last is a commentary, an editorial reflecting on a companion paper by Humphrey and colleagues that attempts to build consensus definitions for skin quality terminology. There's no methods or results section here in the traditional sense. This is argumentative, conceptual writing, so let's follow its actual arc. The author opens with the now familiar patient request for skin that looks like a glazed donut and uses it to frame the core problem. Cosmetic dermatology runs on shared symbolic language, glow, dewiness, radiance, that patients and clinicians both intuitively understand, but that doesn't map cleanly onto any single measurable physiologic variable. The commentary invokes the semiotic idea that a stop sign only means stop by convention, not by any inherent property, and argues that terms like skin quality have drifted the same way, starting as descriptive shorthand and gradually being treated in marketing, trials, and even regulatory conversations as if they were hard endpoints, when they remain loosely and inconsistently defined. The author flags a real practical risk in this. Promotional claims can exploit that ambiguity, citing improvement in something like dullness or skin quality broadly enough to sound meaningful while remaining essentially unfalsifiable. Against that backdrop, the commentary describes what the underlying consensus paper actually did, a structured methodology combining clinician input, patient perspective, and iterative refinement to try to anchor vague descriptors to more concrete, measurable physical attributes, working toward an eventual skin quality index. The commentary credits this as a genuinely useful first step, particularly because the underlying study found that clinicians converged on terminology fairly well, but that convergence broke down when translating the same concepts for patients, who tend to reach for more intuitive, experiential language. The author's critique is that vocabulary consensus, while necessary, is not sufficient. Dermatology has a track record of consensus definitional efforts, referencing prior scar assessment scales as an example, that clarified language without necessarily improving evidence quality or measurement reproducibility. The piece also raises a specific limitation of the underlying study worth noting for context. Older patients were absent from the focus groups that generated these definitions, which the commentary argues is a meaningful gap, given that older patients are heavily invested in skin quality concerns, often express them in more identity-based language like, I don't see myself in my face anymore, rather than trend-driven terms like glazed donut skin, and wield substantial influence and purchasing power despite not driving social media vocabulary. The commentary closes by bringing in artificial intelligence-driven skin analysis as the next layer of this same tension. These platforms promise ever more granular quantification of texture, pigmentation, and microtopography. And the author uses Borges's parable of a map drawn at one-to-one scale with its territory to make the point that more resolution doesn't automatically mean more clinical meaning. A measurement is only useful if it corresponds to an outcome patients actually care about. There's no results or limitations section to walk through here since it's commentary, but the practical message for your practice is straightforward and worth sitting with. as consensus skin quality vocabularies and AI-quantified skin metrics start appearing in the literature and in device marketing, treat standardized terminology as a communication tool, not as evidence of a validated outcome measure. The vocabulary work is a prerequisite for good measurement science, not a substitute for it. That wraps this July issue, a modestly powered but methodologically sound pilot trial on combination light-based acne devices, a sobering snapshot of how indoor tanning is being sold on social media, an elegant multi-layer reconstruction of a complex ALAR defect, and a thoughtful reminder to be skeptical of consensus vocabulary until it's backed by real measurement science.